This is Dr. Guy.
And this is Dr. John.
Two brothers from other mothers. Welcome to Diseases, Death, and Doctors. If it's your first time, we'd like to welcome you to The Pod, a storytelling podcast that discusses the non-chronological history of medicine. Because, my friends, it is easier that way. Today, Dr. John, we are going to talk about epidemics of the mind, aka mass hysteria. So yes, it's going to get weird, and it's going to stay that way.
I'm on the edge of my proverbial seat, just waiting to dive into this topic.
I almost feel like we're taking a big risk as two male protagonists reporting on mass hysteria.
Well, you're the protagonist here. I'm just along for the ride.
All right. That's true. Like a little barnacle.
Yes, I'm just a sea anemone, just caught in your wake. But I am excited to talk about this, and I think we'll do okay. I don't know. I'm optimistic.
I am too.
Call me hysterical, but I'm optimistic.
I feel like we're very PC. That's going to go far, especially on this.
I'm nervous. I have not read through this episode. I just want our listeners to say that I do not condone this.
I thought you wrote this.
I have no idea what's in store for us.
Dr. John's my ghostwriter. All right. Dr. John, apparently hysteria loves company. No feedback on that one?
No. I thought that was reasonable. I thought that was a strong start. Oh, man. We are firing on all cylinders. Our waveforms.
Because it's about mass hysteria. Masses. Lots of people.
Okay.
And hysteria loves company.
Yeah. It's not lonely. Okay.
No. It's funnier when we have to explain our jokes, I think. Nowadays, that is, hysteria is an outdated medical term that fell out of clinical use around the 1980s. That's not that long ago. It is no longer described.
For some of us, it's a little bit closer than others.
It is no longer described in the DSM, aka the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Diseases. I'm a big fan of DSM-4. I don't know. Are you more of a DSM-5 guy? Or
is that the same as BDSM? Dr. Guy has the plague, so his voice is a little bit more throaty and raspy than usual. Bear with us, listeners.
Traditionally, hysteria was a pejorative term used as a catch-all to describe emotional excess and was primarily associated with women. Hysteria was a sex-selective disorder, meaning the basis of the diagnosis operated under the belief that women are predisposed to mental and behavioral conditions. Basically, hysteria was the medical explanation for anything men found mysterious in women.
Men are from Mars and women have hysteria?
That's right.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we're going to be PC on this podcast, but I think we've covered in season one that medicine before 1920s didn't really exist. And even since the 1920s has been horribly sexist and racist and biased. So it seems like we're going to just wade right into this right now. Is that correct, Dr. Guy?
Oh, yeah. We're really going to hammer that nail home the next few minutes here.
Fantastic. We are well equipped to discuss this topic. Jesus.
It's not too late to bring in a guest lecture. Anyway, common symptoms traditionally associated with hysteria were shortness of breath, anxiety, insomnia, fainting, amnesia, paralysis, spasms, pelvic pain, vomiting, deafness, bizarre movements, seizures, hallucinations, infertility, and the inability to speak. I kind of wonder if bizarre movements were the same back then as they are today.
People were just breakdancing and they called it hysteria.
Maybe somebody was popping and locking, maybe doing a little robot.
Yeah.
Would that
they were ahead of their time. They weren't hysterical.
So the word hysteria originated from the Greek word for uterus or hystera. The oldest record of hysteria dates back to the 1900s. Dates back to 1900 BC.
Those 1900s.
Yeah, a little bit farther back in time. 1900 BC, when Egyptians recorded behavioral abnormalities of adult women on medical papyrus. the uterus was considered a source of a variety of health problems, and ancient Egyptians and Greeks, for example, believed the uterus or womb was capable of wandering or migrating throughout the female body, like a toddler in the park, affecting the rest of the body's health by placing pressure on other organs and causing a number of ill effects. This roaming uteri theory was supported by works of famous philosopher Plato and the physician Aetius, and was also known as hysterical suffocation. The offending or lost uterus was usually coaxed back into place by placing good-smelling objects near the vagina and bad or foul-smelling objects near the mouth. So obviously, the female patient lost this round of medicine roulette.
It's fucking terrible.
Oh, and also sneezing was another cure. Yes, sneezing. The philosopher and physician Galen would later disagree with the roaming uterus theory, believing instead that it was the retention of the female seed within the womb that was to blame for anxiety, insomnia, depression, irritability, fainting, and other symptoms women experienced. Other writers and physicians at the time blamed the retention of menstrual blood for female problems. Either way, the obvious solution was to purge the offending fluid. So, obviously, marriage and regular sexual intercourse were the general recommendations. And leave it to male physicians to suggest that male semen also had healing properties, a wonder drug of sorts. So sex served multiple purposes in antiquity.
Oh, that's fucking terrible. Jesus. All right, continue. This walk down the hallowed halls of medicine.
Good stuff. Between the 5th and 13th centuries, however, the increasing influence of Christianity in the Latin West altered medical and public understanding of hysteria, which the term understanding is funny because I would argue that the medical and public understanding of hysteria didn't actually exist at all. Mm-hmm. anyway, St. Augustine's writing suggested that human suffering resulted from sin, and thus the public acceptance of this rationale, hysteria, became perceived as a satanic possession. With the shift in perception of hysteria came a shift in the treatment options. Instead of admitting patients to the hospital, the church said, "Hey, medicine, hold my beer, we got this," and began treating patients through prayers, amulets, and of course, the always popular exorcism.
I feel like I don't feel like things improved during this time period.
To add further insult to injury, during the Renaissance period, many patients of hysteria were prosecuted as witches and underwent interrogations, torture, and then execution.
She's a witch. Ban her.
He's breakdancing again. He must be flogged.
Oh, fantastic.
During the 16th and 17th centuries, my
friends. Things got better?
The pendulum would swing back in the other direction. And this was mainly due to the work of physicians who attempted to change the perception of hysteria back into a medical condition. In particular, a French physician by the name of Charles Lepoix insisted that hysteria was a malady of the brain. And in 1679, the English physician Thomas Sydenham hypothesized that hysteria was an emotional condition rather than a physical condition. The work and lecturing of these men helped propel the medical consensus away from the belief that hysteria was linked to sin or associated with the womb. And over the next century, as doctors developed a greater understanding of the human nervous system, the neurological model of hysteria was created, which further propelled the conception of hysteria as a mental disorder. Baby steps.
So we've gone from wandering or rambling uteri to retained menstrual blood, lack of sex. Exorcist. She's a witch, burn her. And
mental disorder.
Okay, back to a mental disorder. Okay, I think maybe we're moving in the right direction.
Jean-Martin Charcot, a French neurologist and professor of anatomical pathology, fondly described today as the father of modern neurology, gained acclaim during the 19th century for his work on hypnosis and hysteria, a good combination. Oh, nice 1-2 punch right there. Now, it should also be noted or said that Charcot was no quack. He was the first to describe and is credited with naming the neurologic disease multiple sclerosis. The triad of symptoms, nystagmus, intention tremor, and telegraphic speech are known as Charcot's triad. And although they are not necessarily specific to MS, equally impressive, though. Also, Charcot's studies between 1868 and 1881 are considered landmark for the understanding of Parkinson's disease.
Should have got this guy on scurvy. Know what I'm saying?
He seems like a very reasonable man. I'm sure he won't make any mistakes. So returning to our topic of hysteria, Charcot initially believed that hysteria was a neurological disorder for which patients were predisposed by hereditary features of their nervous system. But near the end of his life, he concluded that hysteria was a psychological disease. Charcot first began studying hysteria after creating a special ward for the non-insane females with hysteroepilepsy, for which I must say I'm curious to know what kind of thin line one had to walk to be considered insane versus non-insane with hysteroepilepsy.
Just a fantastic question.
Charcot would describe two distinct forms of hysteria among these women, hysteria minor or hysteria major. Charcot is best remembered for his controversial work with hysteria patients. Louise Augustine Gleizes and Mary Blanche Whitman, known as the Queen of Histrionics.
Oh, Jesus. Blanche.
So we'll go one at a time here. So we'll talk about Louise Augustine Gleizes, also known as Augustine or A. She became a very famous woman in the late 19th century due to Charcot's encouragement that she publicly exhibit her hysteria symptoms. While she was held as a patient at the Salpêtrière Hospital in Paris.
I got a bad feeling about this. I take back any positive things I said about Charcot. I'm just along for the ride here.
All right. Well, here we go. I'm sure we'll improve upon your thoughts of how this is going to end. Charcot would hypnotize her so that she would display her supposed hysteria symptoms in front of colleagues and students. Sigmund Freud and Edgar Degas were onlookers amongst others, including actresses and other local celebrities, because this was an event in the town for which tickets could be purchased and attended.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, not a bad supplemental income if you can get it. That's what you do for on the weekends, right?
It is.
Once you get out of the OR.
What?
Once you leave the operating suite theater on Friday afternoon, you go into a little hypnotics in the town square, make a little extra cash.
It's a family job. I bring my children and hypnotize them.
Little pickpockets.
That's right. Plus a little monkey in a
organ grinder. Symbols. Okay, we digress.
So photographs were then taken of her, exhibiting uncontrolled emotions, interpersonal manipulation, sexual assertiveness, postures of psychological contortion, and seizures, which became known as the most infamous visual representations of a woman's experience with hysteria, and were used to demonstrate the truth, quote-unquote, of hysteria. The public displays of her suspected disease, her performances, essentially, are ethically suspicious at best and likely simply an example of abuse facilitated in the name of medicine. A further ethical note, when Augustine no longer agreed to be photographed, she was admitted to solitary confinement in the hospital. Charcot was like her pimp. So in 1880, fortunately for her, she escaped the hospital disguised in men's clothes and was never seen again.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Fucking good for her.
Ghosted.
Did she hypnotize the guards?
She may have.
I've been studying all this time.
So on to our next histrionic, Mary Blanche Whitman, the Queen of Histrionics, who was admitted to the Salpêtrière Hospital in 1877 at the age of 18, which is even sadder, with reported partial numbness along the right side of her body as well as ovarian sensitivity. She was admitted to the epilepsy ward. And once she found her way into the epilepsy ward, she began having attacks of quote-unquote hysteria within 7 days of her admission and was soon under the care of Charcot. Her episodes would last several hours and included her making rapid motions, becoming rigid, and then act out sexually explicit scenes. This would progress into the next phase, during which there would be deviation of the eyes, foaming at the mouth. She was likely having an epileptic seizure in reality, which would eventually be followed with rhythmic slamming of the head against a pillow on which she would lay and would then proceed to fall into a state of delirium, during which she would mumble the name Blanche, her sister's name, but a name that would become her nickname. Blanche was treated with ether, chloroform, amyl nitrate, with what was described as quote-unquote some success. And in addition, Charcot, similar to Augustine, treated Blanche with hypnosis, and he did so again in a weekly public forum that again included a who's who of medical and celebrity personalities in Paris at the time. Though popular, it should become as no surprise that the very nature of these displays was met with some degree of ethical disdain, even in the late 19th century. The demonstrations were criticized for their circus-like showmanship, sexual innuendo under hypnosis. Whitman was made to act out theatrics with comedic effect, it was said. Charcot's professional reputation was also damaged by reports that some of his patients feigned symptoms for the attention and fame that came with these shows. It's kind of like a Barnum and Bailey circus medical division. Charcot would treat Blanche until his death in 1893. She would ultimately be released from the hospital, but returned to accept a job in the Department of Radiation as a tech. Unfortunately, this was during the early days of radiation, and the adverse effects were not known. Hence, Marie Whitman would eventually have both of her arms amputated due to radiation-induced cancer.
Oh, God. That's so terrible.
She died in 1913 at the age of 54.
Her torturer died. She improved, got gainful employment, but then the gainful employment killed her.
Once again, because medicine didn't quite understand what it was working with.
We weren't quite there yet.
So close. So now back to the imperfect Dr. Charcot. Charcot was also one of the first physicians to argue vehemently against the widespread medical consensus and popular prejudice at the time that hysteria could only affect women. Over his career, Charcot presented several cases of traumatic male hysteria. He taught that due to this prejudice, these cases often went unrecognized even by distinguished doctors and could occur in such models of masculinity, such as railway engineers and soldiers. Ironically, neither of which were members of the Village People. And that's what that's how I determine masculinity in my life.
if you're
Indian construction
like
worker.
Yeah, if you're dressed like a member of the Village Persons, you are masculine in your... That explains a lot.
I like to keep things very black and white.
Your sweet mustache. Oh, man. Well, Charcot was such an activist.
Yes. Charcot's analysis, in particular, his view of hysteria as an organic condition which could be caused by trauma, paved the way for understanding neurological symptoms arising from industrial accident or war-related traumas. As alluded to previously, Charcot's findings and theories did inspire other famous figures in the world of mental health, including the young Sigmund Freud. And Freud theorized that hysteria stemmed from childhood sexual abuse or sexual repression, of course, and was also more than happy to apply the diagnosis of hysteria to men.
So at this point, they're just lumping a certain phenotype of mental health disorder together and calling that hysteria. So it seems like some schizoaffective, some schizophrenic, some bipolar, some mania, some hypersexuality, some what have you, neurologic injury, TBI, they're all lumping a phenotype of those, a similar phenotype as hysteria.
As well as TBD.
TBD.
To be determined.
Da-da-da-da.
No, that's completely correct. Basically, hysteria was an umbrella term that just captured lots of generalized psychiatric disorders.
and a few neurologic ones, apparently.
Yeah, yeah. So during the 20th century, as psychiatry advanced in the West, anxiety and depression diagnoses began to replace hysteria diagnoses in Western countries, as exemplified by the decrease in reported facility admissions associated with hysteria between 1949 and 1978 in England and in Wales. And that decrease was by roughly 2/3 over that period of time. So in addition to medical advancements that explained ailments previously attributed to hysteria, such as epilepsy or infertility, further diminished this historical diagnosis.
You got all of these psychiatric and neurologic conditions, and then you just throw infertility in there.
And the best part about that is technically it could be male infertility that could have then been blamed on the female, and hence she was diagnosed with hysteria.
Oh, nice. So a lot of the wives of that one king of England were all hysterical.
So now that we have a solid understanding of hysteria in a historical sense, let's talk a little bit about mass hysteria. From a sociologic and psychological perspective, mass hysteria is a phenomenon that transmits collective illusions or threats, whether real or imaginary, through a population and society as the result of rumors and fear. In medicine, the term is used to describe the spontaneous manifestation or production of chemicals in the body, or the same or similar hysterical physical symptoms by more than one person.
This is like some QAnon shit right here.
Yeah. So, for example, a common type of mass hysteria occurs when a group of people believe that it is suffering from a similar disease or ailment, sometimes referred to as a mass sociogenic illness or epidemic hysteria. This is where things are going to get a little weird, if they weren't already. I want to take our listeners through a chronologic timeline of mass hysteria events. Chronologic ordering is not something we do on the regular here at Disease, Death, and Doctors, so feel free to savor this auditory experience, listeners.
Let me buckle up and get another drink real quick.
Get your popcorn ready, because we're going to start in the Middle Ages.
Please do that in some type of hillbilly redneck accent.
We've got an episode coming up on the Oregon Trail, so there'll be a lot of that.
A lot of old-timey prospector.
All right. So during the 15th century, a large French convent was said to have been taken over by a plague of cat imitation. According to an account written in 1844, but based on records at the time of the event, a single nun began to meow like a cat. Shortly after the initial behavior by the single nun, several other nuns began to act similarly. Soon, all of the nuns in the convent would meow together for several hours during a certain time of the day. Now, it should be said that during this time period, the church viewed cats as satanic familiars. So the community surrounding the convent heard the loud collective meowing, much to their annoyance and astonishment. The meowing persisted for several days until the inhabitants of the convent were informed that several soldiers had reported to the gates of the convent with instructions to whip them repeatedly until the meowing stopped. The official explanation of the behavior.
They go up there and they said, "Stop right meow. I'm going to need you nuns to stop meowing right meow." What am I? Drinking milk out of a saucer, jumping around all nimbly bimbly.
Oh my. So the official explanation of the behavior would be reported as demonic possession. It should be said that this is not the only account of such behavior, as John Waller, a psychologist writing for the British Psychological Society, reported in 1491, there were records of groups of nuns within various nunneries who began behaving like cats, dogs, and even birds. Their behavior included four-legged running, walking, jumping, clawing, and even biting. According to an account, which was written by an author in 1784, I apologize for the strong source work here. Robust references are, as always, here on the podcast. Yeah.
We have a supplemental material, supplement A, supplement B, with all of our references. Statistical analysis.
Author A in 1784. A nun who lived in a German convent in the 1400s began to bite her companions, and the animal-like behavior soon spread through other convents in Germany, Holland, as well as Italy.
So this could all be made up and, you know, a bunch of dudes and being assholes to nuns for no reason. But if even one of these is true, can you imagine wandering up there and you have a bunch of fucking nuns crawling around on all fours, biting each other and meowing like a cat? That would be terrifying.
I hate to say it, but if I saw that today, I'm pretty sure I'd be on the demonic possession bandwagon right away.
That would just be so terrifying.
I would run.
Yeah. I would not write about it. I would just run.
One of my favorite examples of mass hysteria, and arguably the most famous epidemic in history, is the Dancing Plague of 1518.
If your friends won't dance, and if they won't dance, they ain't no friends of mine.
So according to numerous accounts, in the town of Strasbourg, then part of the Holy Roman Empire, the hysteria kicked off when a woman known as Frau Trofe stepped into the street and began to silently twist, twirl, and shake, maybe even a shimmy. I can't confirm that order. She may have shook, twirled, and then twisted. No one knows for sure. But she kept it up, her solo dance routine, that is, for nearly a week. And before long, some 36 other citizens had joined in. By August, the dancing epidemic had claimed as many as 400 victims. With no other explanation for the phenomenon, local physicians blamed it on hot blood and suggested the afflicted were attempting to simply gyrate their fever away. It's basically like a medieval flash dance.
Sorry, I thought that was appropriate. Don't sue us. Surviving Beatles.
There we go. The town even hired a band, minstrels, to provide background music. I suppose this was an attempt to make the scene look less bizarre, but nothing to see here, simply a Renaissance festival. But it wasn't long before the marathon dancing started to take its toll. Many dancers were said to have collapsed from sheer exhaustion. Some even died from strokes and heart attacks. The strange episode didn't end until September, when the dancers were whisked away to a mountaintop shrine to pray for absolution. This was during the whole hysteria is the result of religious sin phase and the disease understanding. The Strasbourg.
I don't know how they got them to pray. Dancing plague. That's so great.
And here we've got COVID-19.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Fewer minstrels involved in COVID.
Stay at home before you start dancing. Keep your mask on. Strasbourg Dancing Plague might sound like folklore, but the events were well documented in the 16th century historical records. And oddly enough, it's also not the only known incident of its kind. Similar manias took place in Switzerland, Germany, Holland, though fewer as large or deadly as the one triggered in 1518. The Dancing Plague. So what could have led people to dance themselves to death? According to historians, one explanation involves Saint Vitus, a Catholic saint who pious 16th century Europeans believed had the power to curse people with a dancing plague. Hence, when consider the blind religious fervor of the Middle Ages in Strasbourg in 1518, the Saint Vitus superstition may have triggered a stress-induced hysteria that took hold of much of the city. Other theories have suggested that dancers accidentally ingested ergo, a toxic mold that grows on damp rye and produces spasms and hallucinations. So there you have it. Either toxic mold or stress-induced mass hysteria.
One or the other.
I mean, I have to admit, though, would you have spasms and hallucinations for like 3 months that ended once you prayed on top of a mountainside?
Well, maybe they just got away from the mold that they were drinking and part of this rave.
That clean mountain air.
It was a 3 month
Rocky Mountain High.
It was a 3 month long Coachella. they hauled him off to detox.
The Salem witch trials between 1692 and 1693 are considered one of colonial America's most notorious cases of mass hysteria. Four young girls, Abigail Williams, Betty Paris, Ann Putnam Jr., and Elizabeth Hubbard, all claimed to be having strange fits or convulsions, which clergy assumed was a sign that they had been fraternizing with the devil. And so the witch trials began. In all, more than 200 people were accused of witchcraft, 30 of which were found guilty, 19 of whom were executed by hanging, 14 women and 5 men. One other man, Giles Corey, was pressed to death for refusing to plead guilty, and at least 5 people died in jail. Of note, only 14 women and 2 men had been executed in Massachusetts, Connecticut, during the entirety of the 17th century prior to the Salem witch trials. We gotta make some use out of these nooses. They've just been hanging on the trees.
If there's a gold rush, don't buy gold, buy shovels and picks.
That's right.
Sorry, don't invest in gold. Invest in shovels and picks.
In 1749, an outbreak of squirming, screaming, and trance spread through a convent in Wurzburg, Germany. Locals inferred the work of a witch and seized upon a nun as a likely candidate. The nun was subsequently beheaded in the town marketplace.
That was a great deadpan reading of that. It felt like you were reading an Onion article headline.
In 1803, what would later become known as the Hammersmith ghost hysteria, stories of a ghost sightings in the Hammersmith neighborhood in West London began to circulate. Many people assumed the ghost to be that of a recent suicide victim buried in Hammersmith's churchyard. The community made this assumption based on a popular notion at the time that suicides should not be buried in sacred grounds or churches because their souls would be unable to find rest there. All the witnesses reported the ghost as being very tall and clothed entirely in white, with some adding horns and glass eyes into the mix. As more individuals came forward to claim that they had not only seen the Hammersmith ghost but had also been assaulted by it, alarm rapidly turned to widespread panic and finally mass hysteria. Fearful residents responded by taking up guns and monitoring the area. This reaction resulted in one member of the public, Francis Smith, shooting and killing a bricklayer, Thomas Millwood, by mistake, thinking he was the ghost, which ironically led to a legal precedent in the UK regarding self-defense, i.e. that someone could be held liable for their actions, even if they were the consequence of a mistaken belief.
The so-called Ghostbusters exception.
That's right. There is the writing tremor epidemic of 1892 and 1904. The accounts of an event report the right hand of a 10-year-old girl in Grosstenz, Poland, began trembling, which developed into full-body seizures that ultimately spread to 19 other students. A similar epidemic affected 20 in Basel, Switzerland. 12 years later, the Basel school experienced another outbreak that affected 27 students, and it was believed that the legend of the first outbreak was said to have been played a role in the subsequent onset of mass hysteria.
What's that psychiatric condition where two people are in a shared delusion? It's got a French name to it.
I know what you're talking about, but I can't think of the name.
It's not foie gras, but it's something like that.
It's like, is it a food?
What is foie gras is like a duck liver or something. Fatty duck liver.
Sounds delicious. You can look that up. So in case of paranoia gone mad, two different communities across Virginia and Illinois decided that somebody called the Phantom Gasser or the Mad Gasser was standing outside the homes of young women and effectively anesthetizing them with poison gas. This occurred in the period following World War I, when biological warfare had been demonstrated as a potential threat, hence provoking a great deal of anxiety throughout the American communities who had read about the horrors of the World War. Psychology Today reported that the man in question was thought to be spraying poisonous mist into the bedroom windows of teenage girls, causing nausea, vomiting, and burning sensations in their mouths and throats. The whole situation was extremely odd to authorities, for no assailant was ever captured. The image of the person in question varied considerably and was often very unclear if anything had happened at all, whether the women in question were lying, extrapolating from strange smells, or genuinely thought somebody was coming after them with germ warfare. Warfare remains an open question.
It's like a Scarecrow from Batman.
That's right. Origin story.
And the term I was looking for is folie à deux. And it's a shared delusional disorder. Folie of two. French.
Thank you for that, Dr. John.
You're welcome. Yeah, I mean, this seems like, and perhaps you're going to get to it, but it seems like this is a mass hysteria as a shared delusional disorder.
That definition that I read at the very beginning of this segment.
Oh, I was totally paying attention.
Good. Well, thanks for that enlightening comment. I feel the glow of enlightenment upon my body. I'm sure our listeners do as well. So perhaps saving the best for last. In Singapore in 1967, as reported by the British Medical Journal, national newspapers ran a story that reported that local pigs in Singapore had been vaccinated against swine flu. However, there was some sort of contaminant that resulted in the death of one of the pigs. The pig was discovered with a retracted penis. Let that soak in, listeners. This discovery struck a cultural nerve secondary to the existence of a delusional anxiety disorder that occurs more commonly in the Far East that's known as Koro. Koro, also known as shrinking penis, is a culture bond delusional disorder in which an individual has an overpowering belief that their sex organs are retracting and will disappear into their abdomen, causing death if intervention is not forthcoming. This hysteria occurs despite the lack of any true long-standing changes to the genitals. The word koro was borrowed from Indonesian Malay and means the head of the turtle or tortoise, referring to how it looks when they retract their heads into their shells.
Wasn't there a Seinfeld episode about this?
Shrinkage, yeah. Koro is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, mental disorders that can be can be diagnosed through a psychological assessment along with physical examination to rule out the genuine disorders of genitalia that could be causing true retraction. In the United States and in Europe, the disorder is called genital retraction syndrome. And it's hypothesized that the disorder is caused by psychosexual conflicts, personality factors, and cultural beliefs. In non-Chinese, non-Asian victims, sexual adjustment histories are often significant, such as sex inadequacy, sexual promiscuity, guilt over masturbation, and fear of impotence. Anyway, following the media whirlwind of the rumored dead pig and his shrinking penis, panic spread that consumption of local pork would cause manifestation of this condition in humans. People with imagined koru began turning up at hospitals at a high rate. Despite the best efforts of medical professionals to assure them that there is no chance of the penis retracting, most of the affected boys were under 20 and all had apparently known about koru as a phenomenon before rushing to the hospital. Many of the afflicted were extremely anxious, and either they or their family members had attempted physical interventions to prevent further penile retraction. Doctors reported the men presented holding their penises on with rudimentary clamps, strings looped around the head of the penis, and rubber bands. Perhaps there is even a very well-meaning mother.
Oh, God. I mean, you got to do what you got to do. You don't want that to just disappear inside you.
That's your ability to procreate right there. The family name. You got to save it.
Oh, my gosh. What a
all costs.
Hilarious shared solution in that community.
Yeah, it's insane. And so this is a fairly common reaction to koru, which also affects women, by the way. In fact, women reportedly presented to the healthcare providers as well, grabbing desperately at their own breasts and pulling upon their nipples. Or in the most extreme cases, some women have placed pins through the nipple in an attempt to prevent further inversion. These forceful attempts often lead to injuries, and rare death has been reported in association with koru self-treatment, likely only spreading misinformation and anxiety as it is attributed to koru itself rather than the intervention.
Do you think ivermectin would help treat koru?
Oh, definitely. But only if you actually put a straw through the penile urethral meatus and pour Clorox bleach in the hole first. It's a combination.
Yeah, you got to lower that. You got to restore the body's pH before you dose the ivermectin.
There's a synergic effect. You need both of them together. Yeah, to be honest, I really wanted to make koru an episode in and of itself, but I wasn't sure 30 to 45 minutes of delusional genital retraction was a good idea.
You thought it would be too little?
I was worried that all the credibility we've built amongst our listeners would be suddenly lost.
Just suck inside of ourselves, much like a retracting penis.
Like the great snap. Anyway, that's hysteria in a nutshell. Obviously, today, the blanket diagnosis of hysteria has been fragmented into a myriad of medical categories, such as epilepsy, histrionic personality disorder, conversion disorders, and dissociative disorders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So thanks for tuning in for another rousing episode of Disease, Death, and Doctors.
I love your AM radio disc jockey voice there.
I'm trying a lot of things.
Yeah, just really got to run through them, see which one sticks.
Yes,
yeah, that was pretty awesome. I got to say, the mass hysteria was good for a laugh. The first part of the episode, a little bit of a downer. Do you think histrionic personality disorder, does histrionic stem from hysteria?
Yes.
So it lives on a little bit.
The root. And it all comes from the uterus and the womb.
the rambling uteri.
the wandering migration.
Not all that wander are lost. Well, thank you, Dr. Guy. That was another fantastic episode, and I learned a lot.
Appreciate you're very you. Welcome. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in. For all our female listeners, thank you for still having faith in the medical profession as a whole.
It was a rough path we've been through.
I'd say we probably owe you. Yeah. But interesting history. And please subscribe, rate us highly, for we deserve to be highly ranked.
Nope. Yeah, not the episode to beg for ratings on, perhaps.
Perhaps not.
Yeah, we need to stick to things like scurvy and, what did we talk about last episode? Anthrax.
Yeah, so everyone stay safe out there. Tune in 2 more weeks for yet another rousing, titillating episode of Disease, Death, and Doctors.
Thanks, y'all.